Ephesians, Who Wrote the Letter, When, and Why? By Bart D. Ehrman, read by John Paul Middlesworth. Now that I have summarized the major themes and emphases of Ephesians in the previous post, I can move on to the issues of who wrote it, when, and why. The who is the big question in this case, with the when and why depending on our answer. As I indicated in the earlier post, broadly speaking, Ephesians sounds like something Paul could have written, since it addresses a number of themes known from Paul's seven undisputed letters: salvation coming by the death and resurrection of Jesus, the unity of Jew and Gentile in the church, the need for strong ethical standards and behavior, etc. There would, of course, be differences with a letter of this sort, since unlike Paul's other letters that are addressed to specific situations of specific churches, this appears to be a circular letter in which the author addresses no specific problem, such as moral improprieties or false teachings, and therefore offers no specific resolutions. But even taking into account the different kind of letter it is it likely Paul wrote it? This is the first time in this thread I've had the occasion to deal with the issue of ancient forgery, where an author claims to be someone other than who he or she is. But over the course of the years on the blog, I've already dealt with the broader issues of whether such a thing happened much in antiquity, whether it was considered deceitful slash lying, if it was widely condemned, and why, then, would people do it? If you're interested in some of my reflections on the broader issue, you can find them in these two posts. One entitled Forged Books, Anonymous Books, and the Use of Secretaries as Authors in the NT, and another entitled Why Did Ancient Christian Forgers Commit Forgery? Links to the two posts are on the online blog. For now, I'm interested in the specific case of Ephesians. Parts of this description come from my book, The New Testament, A Historical Introduction to the Early Christian Writings, Oxford University Press. The real difficulty with Ephesians is not with its occasion or broad scope, but with the details of what the author actually says and the way in which he says it. One immediate issue, harder to see in an English translation than in the Greek, is that the writing style is notably different from what we find in Paul's other writings. Of course, the same people write differently in different contexts. The letters I wrote to my parents when I was in college were very different from the ones I wrote to my girlfriend, I can assure you, and from the term papers I wrote. So all that has to be taken into account. But even so, to begin with, no one who reads this letter in Greek can help being struck by its incredibly long sentences when measured against those written by Paul. In Greek, the opening thanksgiving of Ephesians, verses 1-3 through 14, 12 verses, is one sentence. This is not bad writing style, it simply isn't Paul's. Some scholars have demonstrated this point in convincing terms. There are something like 100 complete sentences in this book, 9 of them over 50 words in length. Contrast this with what you find in Paul's undisputed letters. Philippians and Galatians, for example, are roughly the same length as Ephesians. Philippians has 102 sentences, but only one of them is over 50 words, and Galatians has 181 sentences, with only one over 50 words. Or consider portions of the longer undisputed letters. In the first four chapters of Romans, there are 581 sentences, only 3 of which are over 50 words. In the first four chapters of 1 Corinthians, there are 621 sentences, with only 1 over 50 words. Paul tended to write in a succinct style. The author of Ephesians did not. When taken in combination with what the letter of Ephesians actually says, these differences suggest that someone other than Paul wrote it. Someone imitating the letters of Paul, but without complete success. To examine the content of Ephesians, we can look at one particular passage that is central to the overarching theme of the book and whose ideas appear to resemble those that Paul sets forth in some of his undisputed letters. Once we move beneath the surface, however, these resemblances begin to evaporate. Ephesians chapter 2:1 through 10 discusses the conversion of its Gentile readers from their earlier lives to the salvation they have experienced in Christ. There are a number of important Pauline themes here. A person's separation from God before being converted to Christ is spoken of as a death. Ephesians 2:1 and 2. The devil is designated as the ruler of the power of the air. Ephesians 2:2. The grace of God brings salvation through faith, not works, Ephesians 2:8 and 9. And the new existence leads to a moral life, Ephesians 2:10. Surely this is Pauline material. There are peculiarities here as well, however, as we can see when we dig deeper into the text. The first and most obvious problem concerns the status of the believer. Even though Paul's undisputed letters are quite emphatic that the resurrection of believers, even in a spiritual sense, has not yet happened, the author of Ephesians pronounces that God, quote, made us alive together with Christ, and raised us up with him and seated us with him in the heavenly places in Christ Jesus, unquote. Ephesians 2:5 and 6. That's not just different, it seems contradictory. It is striking that the words the author uses of the believer's status mirror those he uses of Christ himself. So, according to Ephesians 2, believers are seated with Christ in the heavenly places, above everything else. Can this be the same author who castigated the Corinthians for maintaining that they had already come to be exalted with Christ and were therefore already ruling with him? Or who in Romans 6, 1-6, emphasized that believers who had been baptized had been, quote, buried with Christ, unquote, but had not yet been raised with him? Another interesting difference from Paul's own letters is the way the author of Ephesians 2, 1 through 10, conceptualizes works. In Paul's gospel, Gentiles are made right with God not by doing the works of the law, but through faith in Christ's death. Thus, when Paul speaks about works, he is referring to doing those aspects of the law that make Jews distinctive as the people of Israel. For example, circumcision and kosher food laws. Ephesians, however, no longer refers to the Jewish law, but speaks instead of good deeds. See Ephesians 2:8 through 10. There's a huge difference between saying that keeping the Jewish laws of circumcision, kosher food, Sabbath, etc., has no bearing on salvation, and saying that living a good life, through, say, loving others, has no bearing on it. One is concerned with a person's relation to Judaism, the other with ethical behavior. Just as the notion of works appears to have lost its specifically Jewish content, so too does the author's own former life in which he engaged in these works. Paul himself spoke proudly of his former life as one in which he had kept the Jewish law better than the zealous Pharisaic companions of his youth. In his own words, quote, with respect to the righteousness found in the law, I was found to be blameless, unquote. Philippians 3:6. Paul's conversion was not away from a wild, promiscuous past to an upright and moral present. It was from one form of rigorous religiosity to another. What about the author of Ephesians? Evidently, he did not conceive of Paul's past in this way, for according to him, quote, all of us once lived among them, that is, the pagans, in the passions of our flesh, following the desires of flesh and senses, unquote. Ephesians 2:3. It is true that Paul himself occasionally speaks of having been subject to the law of sin and of having done the things that he knew he ought not to have done, Romans 7. But in his undisputed letters, the extent of his transgressions involves such things as coveting, Romans 7, 7 and 8, not the wild and dissolute lifestyle of the pagans that he sometimes maligned. See Romans 1, 18 through 32. In terms of his lifestyle, Paul lived blamelessly. Not so the author of Ephesians. Who then was this author, and why did he write the letter? Once again, our historical curiosity is stymied by a lack of evidence. Clearly, the author was a member of a church that was committed to Paul's understanding of the gospel, but he evidently lived at a later time, perhaps near the end of the first century when some of Paul's views had developed in directions that Paul himself had not taken them. For example, with respect to what it meant to be saved apart from works. This author may well have had access to other letters written under Paul's name. Scholars have long noted, for example, a number of similarities between Ephesians and Colossians, including their openings and closings, their views of being already raised with Christ, and their instructions to wives and husbands, children and fathers, slaves and masters. Possibly, then, an unknown author concerned with tensions that had erupted between Gentiles and Jews in the churches that he knew, in Asia Minor, wrote to reaffirm what he saw to be the core of Paul's message, that Christ brought about a unification of Jew and Gentile and a reconciliation of both with God, and that all members of the Christian church should respond to their new standing in Christ by embracing and promoting the unity provided from above. He would have been writing after Paul's day. The letter is usually dated to the final third of the first century, say, anywhere between 65 and 100 CE.